Chapter 6. I spent the rest of the morning jumping straight into the work with both feet. The previous webmaster, a volunteer, had just gone back to school at Brown, but she'd left behind a neat sheet of passwords and configuration data, as well as information on our network contracts. I figured the thing to do was to conduct an audit of everything I'd be in charge of, checking that it was all where it was supposed to be, doing what it was supposed to be doing. I grabbed a stack of one-side printed paper out of a recycling box and three-hole punched it, then snapped it into a used three-ring binder I found in a supply closet. I could have used Lurch to take notes. I'd brought it in, booted into its plausible deniability partition with all that deadly secret stuff locked away on disk sectors that were indistinguishable from random noise. But I needed to be able to walk and write, sitting down at people's desks and getting their names and copying down their network cards, MAC addresses and such. And paper is just easier for that sort of thing. I'd type it all in later. Every so often I'd look up and see Floor watching me from her desk in the middle of the room. She'd catch my eye and then nod in satisfaction at my hustle, I assumed. It made me feel good, like someone was noticing how I was busting my butt to make a good impression on my first day. I may be a Morlock, but it was nice to know that Eloy were looking on in approval. After talking with Floor, I'd remembered that the Morlocks ate the Eloy, which made the whole analogy a little weird. I wondered if she'd intended that, and if so, what it was supposed to mean. Joe had swept in around 10 a.m., with one phone pressed to his head and another in his hand, and had been swarmed by about a dozen staffers and volunteers with urgent questions. He clamped one phone between his ear and shoulder and used his free hand to point at people in the mob and then at places they were to wait for him, all the while without losing his place in the animated conversation he was having. As the crowd dispersed, he said his goodbyes and dropped his phone into one pocket, then did the same with the other one. He was a tall, broad-shouldered black guy with his graying hair cropped short. His skin was somewhere between an Americano and a macchiato, a few shades darker than the high-necked sweater he wore over comfortable-looking blue jeans and black Converse. I decided I could dress down for work the next day. I was in the middle of going through every line of the Wi-Fi router's configuration file, plugged straight into it at the very back of the room. Much as I wanted to jump up and introduce myself, I decided to play at Morlock and let him get on with all the urgent stuff he needed to do and try to find a quiet moment later to say hello. But Joe scouted around the room, spotted me, and said loudly, "Marcus, all right," and half-jogged straight to me, hand already out. "Hello, sir," I said.
"Marcus, I can't tell you how glad I am that you're joining us. Floor tells me she's very impressed with you. I'm not surprised. I imagine you've got plenty to do to get up to speed, but please ask Floor to put you in my diary for tomorrow, whenever she can squeeze you in, so we can talk about strategy, all right?"
"All right," I said, making an effort not to stammer. In person, Joseph Noss just radiated charisma, and it made me tongue-tied. Here was a guy who just felt, I don't know, important and smart, and I wanted to impress him, but everything I could think of to say felt too boring to burden him with.
"Good man," he said, and slapped my shoulder before turning on his heel to jog back to Floor's desk, pointing at the staffers he was ready to hear from as he went. They converged in a huddle at Floor's desk, and I went back to work.
"Marcus?" someone said from behind me a few minutes later. I looked up and into a semi-familiar face. It was a guy about my age, or maybe a little younger, with a scruffy beard, and he was grinning so widely I thought his head would fall off. I recognized him from somewhere, but I couldn't think where. I decided I'd try to fake it. I stood up and shook his hand. "Hey, man," I said, "great to see you again." He clapped in uncontainable delight.
"Dude, I can't believe it's you! Are you the new webmaster? Really?"
"Yep," I said. "Sweet gig, huh?"
He shook his head furiously. "No way! I can't believe it! Marcus Yallo is our webmaster! Oh, man!" This was more familiar territory. Someone going all gushy and me not knowing what to say in response. Been there, done that, still don't know what to do when it happens. "So," What have you been up to?
I'm the swag barista, he said, thumping his chest. He was wearing a San Francisco Needs NOS shirt, done like an old-timey sci-fi movie poster with a giant Joe standing astride the Golden Gate Bridge. I design the t-shirts and posters. I try to do a new one every couple of days and screen them on demand. Keep it fresh. Mix it up, you know? One thing I wanted to ask you about was whether you could put up a threadless clone for the website so I could do a little shirt community for all the Nossers out there? I said. Yeah, sure, why not? We were running the site on OpenCampaign, which was a free mod of WordPress designed for election campaigns. It could run WordPress plugins with no additional work, and the one that was based on the threadless user-generated t-shirt site was one I'd looked at before. It didn't seem like it'd be too hard to run.
You are such a dude! God, I can't believe this! Wait until I tell Nate!
He is going to flip out. And that's when I remembered him.
Liam?
I said.
Yeah, of course, Liam! I've been volunteering here all summer, ever since I saw Joe's July 4th video. That stuff was straight up inspiring, yo.
I had friends who ended their sentences with yo, but always ironically, making fun of the people who were trying to talk all street and badass. Liam wasn't being ironic. He really did end his sentences with yo.
Yo, I said, then felt mean about it and gave him a friendly slug on the shoulder.
Liam, man, I didn't recognize you at first with the beard and all. How cool that we're going to be working together.
Me too. Look, do you have lunch plans? Want to get a burrito? I know a great place up on Valencia.
Sure, burritos sound great, I said. I hefted my notebook and said, I'd better get back to work if I'm going to get time for a lunch break then. He did a couple of dance steps on the spot, then gave me a surprise hug, a real crusher that involved lifting me a couple inches off the floor. See you at lunch. Once upon a time, I'd been part of a tight foursome of awesomely close friends. Daryl, Jolu, Van, and I had done everything together since we'd been little kids. But after the whole XNet thing, well, one thing happened and then another. Van and Daryl started dating, and Van didn't like Ange at all. And there was all the weirdness about the fact that she'd been secretly crushing on me, which loomed up like an invisible wall whenever we saw each other. Daryl went off to Berkeley, and we'd seen each other a little at first, but between classes, Van, and his psychotherapy for all the crazy nightmares and freakouts he still had thanks to the horrors of Gitmo by the Bay, we barely had time to say hi. Jolu, meanwhile, had graduated from his job at Pig Spleen to a sweet gig as a programmer on a startup that was commercializing municipal data, cranking out services based on the feeds put out by City Hall. He had a ton of new friends, including a bunch of intimidatingly smart civic hackers, and when they were all really going at it, I could only understand about half of what they said. We didn't see much of each other. And then there was Ange, who was the world's most perfect girlfriend. Funny, smart, exciting. She liked the same movies and games that I did, liked the same books and music, and was always up for keeping me company when she wasn't at school. She'd gotten into SFSU for communication studies and was acing her courses. So even though I missed my friends, it wasn't like I was actually lonely or anything. So somehow I never got around to calling them or IMing them or poking them and seeing how they were doing. But it had been a long time since I'd had a regular gang of friends, a little posse of my own, and I missed that. Liam's friend Nate joined us for lunch, taking Bart down from his mom's place downtown. He, too, gave me a crushing hug, and then he and Liam exchanged one of the same. These guys were as Californian as they came, and they loved their physical contact. I'd been born and raised in San Francisco, but my mom was British, and so I just hadn't gotten into the whole super huggy scene ever. We ended up at my favorite burrito joint, and I got tongue, which Ange had convinced me to try, and which turned out to be amazingly tasty, provided you didn't think too hard about the fact that you were, you know, eating a tongue. Liam ordered one too and raved about how good it tasted and how he wished he'd tried it sooner.
I still can't believe you're our webmaster, Liam said. That's like, I don't know, Bruce Lee being your bouncer or something.
Or Jack Daniels being your bartender, Nate said. He had the same beard as Liam.
I think Jack Daniels is dead, or made up, Liam said. Okay, it's like Steve Wozniak fixing your PC, Nate said. Dude, old school. Woz is the guy who built the first Apple computers, he said to me.
Yeah, I said, I know.
Oh, Liam said. Yeah, of course you do. Listen to me, huh? I wanted to find some way to politely say, Hey, Liam, don't worry about impressing me, okay? I already like you, and all this stuff is just making you sound kind of desperate. But every way I could think of saying that would make Liam feel like a loser and make me sound like a dick. What are you up to, Nate? I said, pointedly changing the subject. He shrugged. Being unemployed. Polishing my non-existent resume. Another shrug. I know how that feels, I said. I was unemployed until this morning. They both boggled at me. No way, Liam said. How could you be out of work? I assumed they'd poached you from some rad startup or Google or something. Now it was my turn to shrug. It seemed like unemployment talk always involved a fair bit of shrugging and looking away. Dunno, I said. I dropped out of school months ago, couldn't afford it anymore, and I've been looking ever since. Man, Nate said, that's crazy. If you couldn't find work, what hope do I have? I didn't have an answer for him. I was starting to actually feel guilty about having a job, and I'd been employed for less than a day. We finished our awkward lunch and went back to work, and I went back to mapping out the network and figuring out what needed fixing and what didn't. And I didn't even think about the torrent I'd downloaded the night before until I got home and rebooted my computer into my secret partition, and the machine reconnected to iPredator and started seeding the file again. The torrent contained a huge, huge zip file that was encrypted. Of course, I had the key. And somewhere out there, Masha was being held captive, or worse. And I was pretty sure that she wanted me to dump the file and the key now. I really wanted to talk this over with someone. Ange, of course, but she was still in class and wouldn't be out for hours. And this wasn't the kind of subject I wanted to talk about over the phone, or email, or IM, or... Well, I kind of felt like we should talk about it in a soundproofed room at the bottom of a mineshaft. But I didn't have either of those things. I had been avoided thinking about this for nearly 36 hours now. I'd had good excuses. I'd been blown up, I'd been doped up, I'd been asleep, I'd gotten a job, I'd had my first day at work. But I'd run out of excuses for inaction. But wait, I just thought of a new excuse. It would be insane to have the decrypted file sitting on my drive, even on a secret partition. I couldn't get over the thought that a snatch team could break down my door at any time and haul me away. If I was loaded up on my secret partition at that point, it'd be easy for them to see what I was up to. I decided I needed to build a few more layers of security into the system before I started to handle this info plutonium. First things first, go shopping for a virtual machine. Let me explain that, because VMs had become my best friends lately. You can write a program that works just like your computer's microprocessor. You designate a file to act as your virtual computer's hard drive, and then you load it up with an operating system and any programs you want to run. When you turn on the computer, that is, when you run the program, it looks at the virtual drive and loads in the virtual operating system and follows all the instructions it finds there, passing them on to your real computer, which is running underneath all of this. It used to be that the main use for VMs was to simulate old computers on new ones, so you could simulate some ancient game console, an old Game Boy or whatever, and play all the vintage games. There's a mega-huge games VM called MAME, the Multiple Arcade Machine Emulator, that can play pretty much every old game ever. The key word here is old. That's because running a pretend computer inside a real computer is slow. But computers double in speed every 18 months or so. This is called Moore's Law for Gordon Moore, who helped start Intel. That means a brand new computer will be about 64 times faster than a computer you could buy for the same money 6 years ago, which means that so long as you're working with old VMs, you probably won't even notice the lag. But lately, computer manufacturers have been figuring out how to design chips to run VMs more efficiently. So the gap between a VM and the real computer it runs on keeps shrinking. This means that it's easier than ever to try out new operating systems and new programs. If there's something you're really paranoid about, you can just run a free VM program, install a free OS on it, and run anything you want in that little sandbox. Nothing that happens in that VM can affect your real computer, not unless you give it privileges to see your real hard drive and real files. The VM is like a head in a jar, and you can tell it anything you want about what's going on in the world, and it'll have to believe you. You can download hundreds, thousands of VMs from the internet and just fire them up as you need them. Want to turn an old computer into a router or a file server for an hour or a day or a year? Various sysadmins have bottled up perfectly tuned VMs that run any specialized function like that out of the box. There are even user reviews to help you figure out which ones are the good ones. And since it's all built on open free code like Linux, anyone can modify, improve, and redistribute them. I went hunting for an extra paranoid VM, and I found one. It started with a copy of Paranoid Linux, my own favorite distro, and nuked any programs and services you didn't need to make it all the more bulletproof. Paranoid VM also stored its user files in TrueCrypt plausible deniability chunks, so there was no way to tell from the forensic examination of the disk how many users there were and how many files they had. That was good for starters, but I wanted a dead man's switch. Something that would cause the whole thing to lock itself and shut down if I didn't do anything every 15 minutes. So I wrote a little script that hit me up for a password every quarter hour. If I didn't enter it, it would issue a system-wide command to kill any VMs that were running, then erase itself. So if a snatch squad were to nab me, all the work I'd done on the files would disappear unless they could torture the password out of me in a quarter of an hour. They'd still have the key and the torrent file, but they wouldn't know whom I'd shown anything to or what we'd talked about. All I'd have to do is key in my password every 15 minutes and not go off to the toilet or forget and go to dinner, or I'd lose everything I'd worked on up to the last save point. There's a technical term for this kind of security work. Yak shaving. Wasting time doing silly chores to avoid something harder and more important. There was an old essay I liked about working for Google by a hacker called Johnny Prasanna, which talked about shaving the entire yak pen at the zoo and pretty soon traveling to Tibet to shave foreign yaks you've never seen before and whose barbering you know little about. That's the territory I was heading into. It was time to decrypt the file. It had been a while since I'd decrypted an encrypted zip file with a very long password. There was a specialized command you could use to specify that the password was in a file, and I couldn't remember it at first. I looked up how to do it. I did it. The list of files scrolled past faster than my eye could follow. Lots of files. Lots and lots of files. 810,097 files. What had Masha said? Eventually, you come across something so terrible, you can't look yourself in the mirror anymore unless you do something about it. That was a lot of dirty laundry, yo. I could tell at a glance that they had human-generated file names. Weird punctuation, weird capitalization, and both were all over the place. Computers might do weird capitalization, but every file would have been written in the same way. Some had pretty descriptive names, like Bribes Paid to Senate Def Committee Doc, and others were more cryptic, like Humint AFGH 32533. There was a file called waterboarding.ppt, a set of PowerPoint slides. My stomach curdled into a hard ball just looking at it. I double-clicked it. The first slide was just a title, Stress Interrogation Seminar 4320. The next slide was a long confidentiality notice, naming a bunch of private military contractors who, apparently, had been involved in producing this presentation. And the next slide showed a boy, about my age, restrained in padded cuffs at the ankles, wrists, and chest, strapped to an angled wooden board that held his head lower than his feet, mouth covered tightly in saran wrap, having water poured down his nose in a splashing stream out of a bucket with a spout held by two large, clean, white hands. The boy's body was arched up like a bow, straining against his restraints, pulling so hard that every muscle in his body stood out. He looked like an anatomical illustration. No. He looked like a torture victim. The saran wrap was an evil touch. The water is poured down the nose, but it can't go into the lungs because the body is tilted backwards. His body is tilted backwards. The body, his body, knows that there's water going into the windpipe, and it's desperate for air. His mouth gasps, but the saran wrap only lets the air go out, because every time he tries to suck air in, the plastic makes a tight seal. The only place air could enter is his nose, and the water is pouring into his nose, and so he can't breathe that way. Eventually, his lungs empty out entirely, collapse like spent balloons, shrivel like raisins. His brain, starved of oxygen, begins to die. He may pull his bonds so hard he breaks his bones. The government likes to call waterboarding a simulated execution. It's not a simulation, though. They nearly kill you. If they don't stop, they will kill you. One of the men at Guantanamo Bay, America's secret prison, was waterboarded more than 180 times. Nearly died 180 times. They say he planned 9/11. Maybe he did. But whatever he told them, they'd be crazy to trust it. When you're being slowly murdered, you will say anything and everything to get loose. But I wasn't thinking about that. I was hypnotized by that boy, by the expression on his face, the veins standing out in his forehead, the terror in his eyes. I'd been there. I'd had that look in my eyes. Time stopped. And then the image disappeared. The window it was in disappeared. The VM that was in disappeared. My dead man switch had been prompting me for a password, had run out of time, and had killed the VM and deleted itself like a good boy. I hadn't even noticed the password prompt. I'd been staring at that picture. That picture was only one slide from one file out of more than 800,000 files. This was going to take a while. Ange rang the bell around dinner time, and my mom sent her up to my room. She let herself in and snuck up on me and put her arms around my neck and kissed the top of my head. I pretended I didn't see her or see her reflection in my screen. It was a game we played. We were adorable. "Hey there, working man. How was your first big day at the office?" "Pretty much like I said in my texts. I'm mostly trying to figure out what the job will entail, trying to get a handle on everything. I told you about that Liam guy too, right?" "Yeah, how weird is that? Small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it." "Well, he got less sweaty about things by the end of the day. He came by for a real chat, and it turns out he knows his stuff pretty well and had lots of good ideas for me. Some authentication ideas I hadn't thought of for managing guest laptops." "I think it's adorable that you've got a little groupie," she said, pulling up my spare chair and transferring the clutter of MakerBot parts to my bed before sitting down. "It's embarrassing," I said. "How was class?" She crossed her eyes. "I thought that after high school, I'd get to start learning like an adult, without everything being about how many factoids I can regurgitate on cue during exams. But pretty much all of my courses give 75% of the grade based on exams." "Well, you could always leak the exams," I said, and her hands were over my mouth before I'd gotten the words out. "Don't even joke," she said. Ange's deep, dark secret is that she stole and published the No Child Left Behind tests when she was in the 11th grade, along with the answer sheets. The school board never figured out who was responsible for it, and they claimed that the stunt had cost millions. Served them right. "Sorry," I said, "but there's worse ideas. And who better to do it?" "Tell you what, let's figure out what to do about Masha's little bombshell first. We can recycle anything we come up with for any final exams I should happen to find myself in possession of. That's why I love you. You're always thinking. We joked a lot about love, but the truth was, I did love her, with a weird, scary kind of intensity. It probably had to do with drifting away from my gang of friends and dropping out of school. Ange was pretty much the only person I saw on a regular basis who wasn't a parent of mine. Every now and then, this freaked me out a little. I think it freaked her out, too. I was looking forward to getting a little more balance in my life from having a job with coworkers. So, what have you got? I felt that little paranoid shiver. You could eavesdrop on a room by bouncing a laser off the glass. The sound waves from the voices in the room made the glass vibrate, and the laser picked up the vibrations. I'd seen a demo of this in a YouTube video of a presentation from DEF CON, the big hacker conference in Vegas. The sound wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good. Good enough to pick out every word and recognize the speaker's voices. I said, give me a sec, okay? I plugged a set of speakers into my laptop and then stretched out their wires until I could press them on the window glass. Then I used my computer's random number generator, dev random, and requested some random white noise. The speakers began to hiss with staticky sound. I cranked them up to the point where I couldn't stand it, then turned them down a notch or two. I made sure the blinds were seated over the speakers again. Maybe a laser could pick up on the sound in the room, but I couldn't think of any way to subtract random noise from the audio signal. That didn't mean it was impossible, but at least we couldn't be eavesdropped on by anyone stupider than me. Huh, Ange said, observing this ritual. Well, that's pretty intense. Yeah, I said. It sure is. We moved the chairs so we could both see my laptop, and I showed her my VM and the dead man switch. Not bad, she said. Okay, you've convinced me that you're worried about this stuff, which, I suppose, means that you're sure you saw Masha and Zeb get taken off the playa, and that means you think the explosion was deliberate. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath. Back down the rabbit hole. Here we go. Wait till you see. I brought up the VM, brought up the directory listing, sat back. What is this I don't even, she said, staring wide-eyed at the listing. I handed her the mouse. She started clicking, beginning from the top. The first item was budget_8b5s.xls. It turned out to be a spreadsheet listing income and outgo. The titles down the left side were people's names. Across the top was a list of companies with bland names like Holdings Import-Export and Property Management Limited, and in the middle were dollar figures. None of them were very big. 1,001, 5,100. The biggest was $7,111. A lot of ones in those figures, I said. Ange nodded. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? She stared at them for a while longer and got out her laptop. You still like iPredator for anonymity? Generally. But why don't you run it through Tor after iPredator? Tor, the onion router, would bounce the browser requests through a bunch of random computers, and none of those computers would know where the request came from and where it was going. It was slow, slower than iPredator, which was slower than the raw network connection. But there's a time to be paranoid, and this was it. I stared at the mysterious spreadsheet for a while. The dead man switch asked for a password, and I entered it. There you go. I knew I'd read about this. The number one appears more frequently than other numbers in financial data. What? Why? She showed me the article, a summary of a paper at a security conference. A lot more stuff costs between $10 and $19, or $100 and $199, than $20 and up, or $200 and up. Retail psychology. People are more likely to buy stuff that costs $9 than $10. It's a big jump. $99 has less psychological weight than $100, but $999 is a lot less crazy than $1,000. So you get a lot of clusters of numbers with ones in them. But when people make up numbers, faking their finances or cheating on their taxes, you get a much more even distribution of numbers. It's one of the way the IRS looks for tax cheats. I read about it in a book on data journalism and tried to get my section's TA to read it last year, but she said she had to get us ready for the exams and to show it to her again afterward. So all these ones, They're inserted by someone who knows he's making up numbers and wants to be sure that there's plenty of extra ones to make the statistical distribution look right. Someone who doesn't expect a human being to look at these numbers closely, but worried that a computer might spot them. She peered at my spreadsheet and started to type again, but the dead man switch wanted a password again, and I didn't grab the computer in time to enter it. The VM disappeared. "That's frustrating," she said. "I'll teach you the password. What if you set the timeout to longer? 30 minutes? I shook my head. I think I could probably hold out against someone who wanted my password for 15 minutes, especially if they were on a snatch team that broke the door down and didn't have any time to prepare. 30 minutes, though? Oh, she said. There's a presentation in there on how to do waterboarding. A PowerPoint. It's got bar graphs showing the time to brain damage based on age and general health. Oh, she said again. She knew that there were times when showering would give me uncontrollable shakes. Being executed will do that to you. I brought up the VM and opened the spreadsheet again. Ann started to enter the names. They're all staffers for Illinois State Assemblyman Bedfellow. The logical step is to look up which committees that assemblyman is on and what all he voted on. Data Journalism 101. Or would be if there was a data journalism course in my program. Let's do it, I said. No, she said. That's just one file. There's 800,000 more. We can't do this retail. We have to find a wholesale approach. We need Jolu, I said. This is his thing. We'd been brainstorming for hours. Ange was even more paranoid than I was. She had me clone the VM, easy, just copy the data file, and then set up a new TrueCrypt file that had one copy of the VM in its regular storage and another copy in a hidden plausible deniability partition. Here's how it'll work. The snatch squad comes in. Bags and Tag Zoom grabs the computer. They start looking around, but before they can get very far, there's a password prompt. They start to rubber hose you for the password, but you gut it out. Whoosh, the dead man's switch trips, the VM takes itself down, the data's scrambled. But then what happens? I chewed my lip. I had thought this through this far before and hadn't liked what came next. They try to get the password out of me to decrypt the file. Right? I said, and if you're here, they can work on you too. Which is why we're doing this. Because right away we can give them a password, and that password will unlock this copy of the VM. It's got a full set of the leaks, but that's not the copy we work with. That's the one we hide in the plausible deniability partition. And that's where we keep all of our notes, any mailing lists of people who know about this and work on it with us. We never give them that password. Our story is, we kept the leaks on this encrypted VM, and we didn't keep notes on them. We didn't know what to do about them. It's believable. I mean, we don't know what to do with them. We did that. We came up with two long, crazy passwords and practiced them on each other until we had them memorized. Then we stared at each other. Now what? We need Jolu, I said again. He's all about wholesale data these days. Ange nuked the VMs, turning them back into random-seeming gibberish. The speakers are driving me crazy, she said. Are you sure they'll stop this laser listener stuff? I shook my head. Fine, she said. Let's turn them down for a while anyway. So, Jolu. You know that bringing Jolu into this is pretty much the same kind of dick move that Masha pulled when she brought you into it. I know, but it's different with Jolu. He's my friend. One of my best friends. She chewed on some words for a while. Marcus, no offense. But is that still true? When was the last time you guys actually hung out? When was the last time you even talked? I squirmed. She was right. Okay, point taken. But that doesn't mean we're not still friends. We don't dislike each other. We're just, you know, busy with our own things. I've known Jolu for most of my life, since I was a little kid. He's the right guy for this. I don't mean to make you all defensive, all right? It's just that you're about to put Jolu into a really hard spot, and it's the kind of thing that you should be really, really sure about before you do it. Jolu wouldn't turn me down. This is important. Ange gave me a long, long look. Here's what she wasn't saying. If this is so important, why didn't you drop everything and do something about it? Why didn't you go to the cops or the press? Why are you screwing around with a new job instead of making this your top priority? It was a thought that I kept having, too. And of course, I knew the answer, and so did Ange. I was too scared to go public. The last time I spilled everything to the press, I'd ended up in a torture chamber. The stuff Masha had dumped on me was a lot more important and scary than what I'd had to say that time, too, if our small samples were anything to go by. Besides, Masha hadn't told me to rescue her. She'd told me to get the material out. I would. Maybe if the material was out there, Carrie Johnstone would realize that snatching Masha would do no good and let her and Zeb go. Maybe. Chapter 7. I've always done my best work at night, and I knew all the tricks, combining careful doses of coffee, cat naps, and showers to get my tortured, sleep-deprived brain to perform during daylight, while still cranking away through the vampire hours where inspiration lurked in every shadow. Jolu was the same, and that was one reason we got along so well. I can't count how many 3 a.m.s I'd shared with him over Skype or IM or in person as we snuck out of the house to go dingle-dody around the streets of San Francisco. So even though it was 8 p.m. when Ange and I finally finished arguing, I didn't worry about whether he'd be free for the evening. Though I did feel a little weird as my finger hovered over his icon in my speed dial. That thing, you know it. You haven't called someone in a long time, so it's weird to call them, so you don't call them, and more time goes by, and it gets weirder. Marcus, he said. There was a lot of noise in the background, clinking bottles and glasses and loud talk. Jolu, I said. Look, man, I'm sorry to call you out of the blue. One sec, he said. Let me get somewhere quieter. I heard him navigate what sounded like a busy party. Hey, dude, long time no speak. I'm sorry to call you out of the blue. No, it's cool. It's great, actually. Nice to hear from you. Wonder if you'll feel the same way after I turn your life upside down. Can I meet you somewhere? It's important. Marcus? He said. Important how? Important. The kind of important I don't want to talk about on the phone. I distinctly heard him say, oh shit, under his breath. Of course, he said. Right now? Yeah. Now would be good. A long pause. What about the place where you met Ange? You mean, I stopped myself. Good old Jolu. Anyone listening in wouldn't know where I met Ange. He was more paranoid than I was, and that was before I told him what was up. He really was the right man for the job. Okay, when? Give me an hour? Okay, I said. And Jolu? Thanks. I heard him snort, and I could totally picture the half-smile that went with it, one bushy eyebrow raised in a quizzical expression. No need. Any time for you, man. You know that. Friends. Nothing like them. I met Ange at a key signing party Jolu and I threw at the Sutro Baths on Ocean Beach. The weird old-slash-new ruins were spooky and dramatic, and the night was burned into my memory forever. Ange laughed when I told her where we were headed. She'd taken me there again on our first anniversary with a picnic supper, and we'd watched the sun go down and necked on the blanket before we got too cold. I think we should switch off our phones, Ange said. Yeah, I said. That's the thing about paranoia, it's catching. But she was right. Our phones would send our location to the phone companies, and if someone really wanted to snoop on us, it was always possible that they could find some way to tap into the GPSs on them. Then there'd be this really clear data trail. Marcus called Jolu. Then Ange, Marcus, and Jolu all met up at Ocean Beach. Might as well get reflective orange vests and stencil co-conspirator on them. I took the battery out of my phone for good measure. We were a quarter of an hour early. The buses were with us, and Jolu was 10 minutes early. He hugged us both tightly, and Ange kissed him on the cheek. It had been months since I'd seen him. He'd dropped in on an open data lecture at Noisebridge, and he looked different. He'd grown a tidy little mustache and pointed sideburns, and had his hair styled in a short razor cut that looked somehow grown up, cool, and businesslike all at once. He'd always been better dressed than the rest of us, but he was particularly natty that night in a button-up shirt with slightly wiggly stripes that made my eyes cross when I stared at them, heavy old denim jeans with big rivets, and elaborate leather shoes. I was in my old thrift store jeans, beat-up motorcycle boots caked with playa dust, and a hoodie, and I felt like a slob. He had wine on his breath. "I hope it wasn't a totally excellent party," I said. "Just a release party for a new traffic-predicting app," he said, shrugging. "We get users' anonymized GPS data at different times on different roads and try to predict traffic jams ahead of time, also looking at all the planned road maintenance and anything real-time from the DOT. You share your calendar with us, and we look at where you're going and use that to give you advice on what roads to avoid to get there on time." "Whoa, creepy," Ange said. I'd been thinking it, but hadn't wanted to say anything. Jolu wasn't offended, though. He just grinned. "Yeah, it is. I mean, everyone is opt-in, and we anonymize the data when we get it, so we don't know where you've been, just that someone has been there. But yeah, if we had a data leak, there'd be an awful lot of stuff there you might not want the world to know." He sat down on a rock and fished some gum out of his pockets, offered it around. It was black licorice gum, his favorite, the kind that turned your tongue and spit disgusting black. Just the smell of it made me smile and sent me spinning back in time to the old days. "Or if the police seized your servers," Ange said. "It's so weird that we do all this XNet stuff to keep our personal information from being captured by the government, but we give it to companies, and the cops can just waltz into their data centers whenever they want and just take it all." "You don't know the half of it," Jolu said. "Get me to tell you about the lawful intercept stuff sometime, okay? It'll curl the hair on your toes." "So, speaking of the police and servers," I said, "I've got an interesting technical problem I wanted to talk to you about." "I figured you might. Before I start, is your phone on by any chance?" He pulled it out of his pocket and removed the back, showing me the missing battery. "Dude, estoy aquí por loco, no por pendejo." Which was the punchline to the funniest Spanish joke I knew. Okay, the only one. "Google it." Jolu listened attentively, asking a few questions as we told the story. I put in my theory about the explosion on the playa, and Ange didn't say anything about not believing me. When we were done, we both looked at him across the darkness, and the gray no color of the light leaking from the street lamps on the cliff above us. "So what do we do now?" he said. "We?" He shook his head. "Duh. Yes, we. Did you think I wouldn't get involved? The last time you sat where you're sitting, and I sat where I'm sitting, you told me that it was different for you. You told me that the risk was bigger if you're brown than if you're white." "Yeah, I said that. It's every bit as true today as it was then, too." "But you're in." He looked out into the darkness and didn't say anything. I smelled his gum. "Marcus," he said, "have you noticed how messed up everything is today? How we put a good president in the White House, and he kept right on torturing and bombing and running secret prisons? How every time we turn around, someone's trying to take the internet away from us, make it into some kind of giant stupid shopping mall where the rent-the-cops can kick you out if they don't like your clothes? Have you noticed how much money the 1% have? How we're putting more people in jail every day, and more people are unemployed every day, and more people are losing their houses every day?" "I've noticed," I said, "but haven't things always been screwed up? I mean, doesn't everyone assume that their generation has the most special, most awful problems?" "Yeah," Ange said, "but not every generation has had the net." "Bingo," Jolu said. "I'm not saying it wasn't terrible in the Great Depression or whatever, but we've got the power to organize like we've never had before. And the creeps and the spooks have the power to spy on us more than ever before, to control us and censor us and find us and snatch us." "Who's going to win?" I said. "I mean, I used to think that we'd win because we understand computers and they don't." "Oh, they understand computers, and they're doing everything they can to invent new ways to mess you up with them. But if we leave the field, it'll just be them. People who want everything, want to be in charge of everyone.
So, we're going to win? Jolu laughed.
There's no winning or losing, Marcus. There's only doing.
Man, I leave you alone for a couple of months and you turn into Yoda.
So what do we do? Ange asked again.
Well, we're not going to be able to look at 800,000 of these. 810,097, I said.
That.
I think we need to build some kind of site for these things. Something secure and private, where we can run searches on them, try to find the good stuff, leave notes for each other.
And then what do we do with them?
We release them.
Duh,
Ange said.
But how do you think we'll do that? How do you put the information in a place where people will see it and care about it, but not a place that can be traced back to us?
Jolu shrugged and stared at the ruins.
I don't know. I guess it depends on the kind of stuff we find. Maybe we Google journalists who sound like they'd be interested in the story and email the docs to them from throwaway accounts. Something else, maybe. I don't know.
But when you've got a problem that has two parts, and one part comes first, and you know how to solve that part, the best thing to do is solve that part and see if a solution to the rest suggests itself while you're working.
That sounds right, I said.
I suppose, Ange said. But, Marcus, what about Zeb and Masha?
Yeah, well, I don't know how we work that out. Maybe releasing the material will put them in more danger.
Maybe it'll take them out of danger. Look, we know who took her, Carrie Johnstone. That's got to be part of the story, however we release it.
You're sure it was her? Jolu asked.
There are some faces I'll never, ever forget. Hers is one of them. It was her.
Okay, okay.
Let's talk about forward secrecy, he said.
It turned out Jolu had been hanging out with some heavy Tor dudes who were working on darknet sites, hidden services that could host files and message boards, sites that anyone could reach, providing they knew the address. But these were unlike regular sites. Even if you knew the address, you couldn't figure out where the physical computer it led to was, who was running it, what server you'd have to seize to shut it down. Darknet sites were places you could visit, but couldn't shut down.
So you've got these rendezvous points. They're servers that know some other servers that know some other servers that know the way to reach the darknet site. You ask a rendezvous site to introduce you to the server, and it does this dance with the other servers down the line and creates a temporary circuit that bounces your connection through a one-off route to the darknet machine. So every time you visit the site, there's a different, random way to reach it. What I want to do is grab a cheapo server-on-demand VM and slap a paranoid Linux install on it. Nothing unencrypted, ever. Then we slap a copy of your data on it and a clone of Google Spreadsheets. Grab a doc, put its title in the first field, a description in the next field, and a place where you can put some keywords. Smack together a script that runs every couple of minutes and searches for those keywords in the uncategorized documents and automatically suggests possibly related ones.
And then what?
We look at 800,000 documents, us three? I figured I might be able to do 100 docs a night, depending on how complicated they were. At that rate, it'd take us three a year or so to get through them all. Too slow. No, not us three. With enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. We've got to bring more people in, people we can trust.
Jolu said,
yeah, I know a few of those. I was almost late for work the next day. After coming home, I'd stayed up for hours banging away at the document dump. I hadn't meant to, but Jolu's idea of searching for words in the dump gave me some ideas. The first thing I searched for was Masha and Zeb. I got a few documents with Zebra and Mashallah, but nothing else. I tried Marcus and Yallo. There were five Marcuses, but none of them were me. Then I tried Carrie Johnstone and hit the jackpot. Carrie Johnstone had been a busy little soldier in Iraq. There were more than 400 documents that mentioned her by name. I went after them alphabetically at first, but it was all confusing until I had the bright idea of sorting them by date and starting with the oldest and reading toward the newest, a document that was just over a month old. Reading those 400 documents, some very short, some very long, kept me up to 3 a.m. And the more I read, the more I learned about Carrie Johnstone's weird and terrible career in and out of the U.S. military.
The first documents dated from Johnstone's career at FOB to Crete, Saddam Hussein's old palace. There was a memo she'd written describing the handover of a bunch of Iraqi prisoners to the Iraqi police. I didn't see at first why anyone would bother to save the document, but the next memo explained it. It was a memo explaining why they hadn't told the Red Cross about the transfer of prisoners and hadn't gotten any kind of chain of custody receipts from the Iraqi cops. A little Googling and I figured out what that meant. 51 men, women, and children had vanished into the custody of Iraq's police force, and no one knew whatever became of them. They had been arrested after anonymous tips or snatched off the street for suspicious behavior, and for all anyone knew, they were nameless and rotting in a jail somewhere, while their families wrote them off for dead. Or maybe they were dead, dumped in a mass grave. Then she'd ended up at FOB Grizzly, working as an intelligence officer alongside the military police. She'd been reprimanded for unauthorized stress interrogations of suspected terrorists and had overseen an arrest sweep that brought in more than 500 suspects, all of whom had been released over the coming months as it emerged that they had nothing to do with terrorism. It was around then that she left the military, and though she'd written a letter of resignation, there was also a memo from a commanding officer to Army Human Resources Command saying that she'd been shown the door after an incident involving materiel. Another memo was more explicit. She'd been involved in a plan that delivered American guns and ammo to private mercenaries working for a military contractor, and those guns and that ammo had been part of a massacre that killed over 100 people. From there, she'd gone private, working for the military contractor, hired killers, according to a quick search, and had distinguished herself with a very lucrative bid to take over the management contract for the FOB she'd been fired from. It was ugly. As I lay in bed with my thoughts swirling, I wondered if Carrie Johnstone had snatched Masha because the leaks file had so much embarrassing material about her personally, or whether she'd been hired to retrieve them for the U.S. government. How could the Army fire her one day and then rehire her to do the same job at 10 times her old salary a month later? Were they on crazy pills? I couldn't afford to drag my ass around work the next day, so I didn't. I pounded the Turk's coffee and munched chocolate espresso beans and finished my inventory and network map. Joe surprised me by scheduling me for lunch. The first I heard of it was when he showed up at my desk at 12:30 and stood over it, smiling expectantly at me. "Hi, Joe," I said.
"Lunchtime, Marcus?"
We went to a nice veggie place where they knew him by name and seated us right away. He knew their names, too, and greeted everyone from the waiter to the guy who filled up our water glasses personally, switching to Spanish as necessary, and asking sincere, friendly questions about their wives and husbands and kids and health. The sincere part was the weirdest thing. When I was really on fire and feeling very, very sociable, I might remember half of the names of the people I saw. I just sucked at names. And when people told me about their kids or parents or siblings or whatever, I tried to be interested, but, I mean, how interested can you really be in the lives of people you barely know or have never met at all? But Joe had the uncanny ability to seem really genuinely interested in people. When he talked to you, you felt like he was also listening to you. Carefully, thoughtfully, and not waiting for you to finish talking so that he could say whatever he was going to say next. It made him seem, I don't know, holy or something. Like one of those people out of a religious story who overflows with love for his fellow man. And the weirdest part? He didn't make me feel like a dick for not being that interested myself. Instead, he made me want to try to be more like him. More caring. After our water glasses were full and we put in our orders, he said,
"Thank you for making the time to see me today. I know you must be busy."
If it was anyone else, I'd have thought he was blowing smoke up my ass. But he really sounded like he thought being the webmaster, sysadmin, net guy was the hardest job in the world, and he felt lucky that all he had to do was run around and try to get elected. "You're welcome. I mean, it's a pleasure. I mean, it's wonderful. I'm so glad to have a job, and it's such a cool job, too. Everyone's really nice and interesting, and I really believe in your platform, so, well, it's just great." I was babbling like an idiot, and I couldn't seem to stop, and he didn't seem to notice.
You remember when I spoke to you on the phone the other night? I mentioned how my campaign would need great technology to be successful. And I'm sure that when you and Flora chatted, she had some pointed opinions about that, and what her side of the campaign needed from you. You might be wondering who wins in a little struggle like that. I wanted to give you some context to help you resolve that. Flora is your boss, and she's my boss, too. She's in charge of the campaign from top to bottom, and I'm familiar with her ideas about what campaigns need vis-a-vis boots on the ground, knocking on doors, and raising money. She's right as far as she goes, and that's why I let her be my boss. But I'm the candidate, and I have some additional priorities. I say additional, not different. Flora is right about needing money, boots, and door knocking. But once you've got all that running to the best of your ability, there's more that I want you to get thinking about. I want you to tell me how technology can help me reach people who would otherwise be beyond my reach. I want you to tell me how technology can transform the way that voters and their representatives collaborate to produce good, accountable government. Every wave of technology, from newspapers to radio to TV, has transformed politics, and not always for the better. Some people think that the internet is a tool for politicians to raise money or coordinate volunteers, but I don't think that's even 1% of what technology can do for politics. I want you to help me figure out the other 99%. Whoa. Okay, I said. Do you want, what, an essay or a website or something? He smiled. Let's start with a chat, like this one, tomorrow at the end of the day. I'll have Floyd put it in both of our schedules. It made me feel good and a little scared. I really didn't want to let him down, but all I could think of was darknet sites and leaked docs. I wondered what he would say if I told him that I was sitting on more than 800,000 confidential compromising government memos. But I also remembered what Flora had said. The first time I catch so much as a whiff of anything illegal, immoral, dangerous, or leet, I will personally bounce your ass to the curb before you have a chance to zip your fly. I went over to Ange's after work. Jolu had already set up our darknet site and grabbed a copy of the docs off BitTorrent. I'd handed him a USB stick with the key on it, and by the time I got my computer up into a secure mode with a dead man switched and an anonymized private network connection, the site was ready to go. In fact, it was already going. Jolu had met with Van on his lunch break, and she'd plowed through more than 50 docs while I'd been bringing the Joe for Senate server's patch levels up to date. I wondered whether Van had had a chance to talk to Daryl. He'd been my best friend, as tight as a brother, but I hadn't seen him in months. It was all too weird between us. The fact that he was with Van and that Van had confessed that she'd once had a crush on me, the unworldly fragility of his mind after his time in Gitmo by the Bay, his constant struggle to keep up with even a half-time course load at Berkeley. I thought of what seeing that nasty little waterboarding PowerPoint would do to Daryl. It wasn't just Van working on the docks, either. Jolu had enlisted some of his other trusted friends, people with cryptic handles like Left-Handed Mutant and Endless Vegetables. I hoped Jolu was right to trust them. I hoped he'd been cagey about where the docks had actually come from. Out of curiosity, I googled the strangers' handles and confirmed to my satisfaction that they didn't appear to have been used before. It would have been such a basic mistake to recycle a nickname that you'd already used someplace that could be linked to your real identity. Endless Vegetables was working his or her way through a gigantic pile of documents on student loans, judging from the tags and summaries. I vaguely knew that the government guaranteed student loans made by universities, which were sold to banks that collected on them. The darknet docs went into disgusting details, like a series of jokey emails between a congressman who'd gotten a tearful letter from a constituent who'd been hit with crazy penalties that turned her $20,000 loan into a $180,000 loan and an executive at the bank who'd assessed the penalties. The congressman sounded like he was pretty good friends with the banker, and they made it sound like this girl's problem was hilarious. Jolu had added an I'm feeling lucky button to the spreadsheet that would bring up a random uncatalogued doc. I hit it and found myself looking at a cryptic set of numbers and acronyms. I tried to Google the search terms, but found myself getting nowhere. So I grabbed another and then another. It was mesmerizing, like channel surfing on a massive cable network that only got heavy, strange programs about corruption, murder, and sleaze. Jeebus H. Christmas, Ange said. Have a look at the doc I just checked in. I resorted the spreadsheet by author and found Ange's latest contribution, loaded it up. It was an instruction manual for a lawful intercept network appliance sold to cops and governments for installation at an internet service provider. The appliance monitored all incoming requests for updates to Android phones and checked to see if the phone's owner was on a list of targets. If they were, the appliance took over the network session and sent a fake update to the phone that gave spies and spooks the power to secretly turn on the phone's GPS, camera, and mic. I stared in mounting horror at the phone on the bed next to me, then flipped it over and took out the battery. Keep reading, Ange said. She'd been following the auto-linked documents and found a bunch of captured emails and phone sessions. One was a complaint from a DHS field operative about a target who'd installed Paranoid Android on his phone and couldn't be gotten at. What's Paranoid Android? I asked. I'm reading up on that now, Ange said. Looks like it's a fork from the Cyanogen mod. I knew about Cyanogen, of course. Hackers had taken the source code for Google's Android operating system and made a fully free and open version that could do all kinds of cool tricks. It doesn't accept updates unless their checksums match with other users and the official releases, lets you tell whether an update is real or a spoof. Well, what are we waiting for? Let's install it. Ange pointed at her phone, which was already cabled to her laptop. What do you think I'm doing? Do mine next? Duh. There was more. Other lawful intercept appliances would disguise themselves as iTunes updates for Macs and PCs, and another one worked by sending fake updates to your browser. Then there were the saved emails between a senior DHS IT manager who'd worked at one of these companies before going to Homeland Security. His old boss was explaining how they were using a shell company in Equatorial Guinea, a country I'd never even heard of, to market their products in China, Iran, and other countries. It just got worse. Logs of law enforcement requests to install spyware bugs on people involved in peaceful protest groups. Reports of break-ins by suspected criminals who'd used the systems to spy on their victims. I was trying to figure out how all this stuff could possibly work. After all, software updates usually went over SSL, which used cryptographic certificates to verify the identity of the sender. How are they spoofing connections from Apple and Google and Microsoft and Mozilla? Oh, that's how. A search on certificates lawful intercept brought up another email exchange. This one with a huge American security company that had one of the signing certificates that were trusted by all browsers and operating systems. They'd been supplying blank certificates to the DHS for years, it seemed. Certificates that would give the government the power to undetectably impersonate your bank, or your company, or Apple, Microsoft, and Google. Ange and I split up the remaining lawful intercept docs, getting deeper and deeper into the terrifying secrets of snoops and spies. Before I knew it, it was 2 a.m., and I could barely keep my eyes open. "Want to stay over?" Ange said as I yawned for the 10th time in 5 minutes. I think I already have, I said. We'd started staying over at each other's houses that summer, and while it had been weird at first, especially over breakfast with the parents, everyone had gotten used to it. My parents had more important stuff to worry about, and Ange's mom was just one of those cool grown-ups who seemed to have an instinctive grasp of what mattered and what didn't.